From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, musician Anna Warnaker tells us why she revived her 90s band, That Dog. Then a documentary about the National Enquirer reveals how the supermarket tabloid reached a new level of awareness during the O.J. Simpson murder trial.
When a lot of the mainstream press was looking one way, the Enquirer was looking all ways. They were very spherical and very holistic in their look, and that was something that couldn't be competed with.
And Rafael Sadiq deconstructs his music in an episode of the podcast Song Exploder. All that coming up on The Frame. From its undeniable influence on modern news organizations to its role in the rise of Donald Trump, the National Enquirer has made its mark. A new documentary called Scandalous, The True Story of the National Enquirer, reviews the tabloid's history and biggest stories and takes us into its cutthroat culture. Director Mark Landsman says the idea for the film came from an eye-opening conversation with a family friend, Malcolm Balfour, who was one of the first National Enquirer reporters.
The stories were just unbelievable. I mean, he talked about espionage and disguises and checkbook journalism and unconventional sourcing and all this kind of crazy stuff. And it just went on and on. And I thought, wow, that's like the stuff of a great movie. But I didn't think anything of it. And then, Ronan Farrow hit the situation. He hit the scene with his article in The New Yorker in April of 2018. And that's when I called Malcolm again and I said, maybe we should talk again. He said, okay.
What Ronan Farrow lays out is the concept of catch and kill. And essentially, the Enquirer buys their stories in order not to publish them because there's bad news that would hurt the publisher of the Enquirer, David Pecker's friend, Donald Trump.
Correct. But it's a bait and switch because the people whose stories are bought sign the rights away to those stories under the assumption that they're going to be getting something in return, which is namely publicity, a book, a movie deal, TV, and none of that ever materializes. What ends up happening is that the story gets put into the proverbial vault, never to be seen again, to protect the rich and the powerful.
There's a precedent for what happens with Donald Trump, and it's about Bob Hope and it's about Bill Cosby.
The seeds of everything that we are seeing now in our news cycle were planted decades and decades ago when Hollywood had a very well-established system of trade-outs where a celebrity on the rise would have not only a publicist but a lawyer working in conjunction with a National Enquirer reporter to broker stories. And this was the original quid pro quo of the situation. Basically, in the case of Bob Hope, it was known that he had mistresses. It was known that he had a casting couch at Universal. And so basically, an Enquirer reporter gathered all of this evidence and proof, including tape recordings, people very close to Hope. The information would then be brought to the celebrity and his team or her team and say, hey, we've got this information on you. But why don't you give us an exclusive Bob Hope at home, Thanksgiving with the Hopes, the cruise with the Hopes in the Mediterranean, whatever it is, some kind of inside story. And in exchange, this negative story will never see the light of day. And so that started with Bob Hope.
And it's repeated with Bill Cosby and repeated with Donald Trump.
Correct.
A lot of your film is about the lengths to which the Enquirer went to build circulation. But something pivotal happens recently under the leadership of David Pecker. Let's play a clip from the film.
David Pecker was known to bump into Donald Trump in the airport and hitch a ride on his private jet back to New York.
They were sort of fellow travelers. Pecker liked Donald Trump's style. I think Donald Trump liked the ability to be in a publication that people were reading.
There are so many things that the previous owners and publishers of the Enquirer will do to increase circulation. But under David Pecker, the film suggests a pivot to use the paper for political gain, not circulation gain. So what happens under Pecker's leadership, and is it consistent with the history that has brought the Enquirer to this moment?
It's not inconsistent with the history. I think you can see the evolution of it. And that was really the whole impetus for the film was, let's look at this transformation. The Enquirer started with this mad genius, Generoso Pope in the late 50s, 60s, and he created this Frankenstein. And we watched this monster transform. By the time that Pecker got involved, the paper was at a low point in its circulation. And he was a different kind of a person. He wasn't a journalist. He was a businessman. And as such, he was interested in ensuring that the larger corporation, AMI, stayed solvent And, you know, how do you do that? Well, you need to have access to investment money. How do you do that? You need to have proximity to power. And what greater power is there in the world than, you know, what sits in the White House?
Donald Trump had a long and interesting history with the National Enquirer long before he became president.
What's so interesting is you talk to these Enquirer guys who were sort of on Trump back in the 80s when he first came on the radar, and they would say, like, he wasn't Enquirer material. He wasn't sort of big enough for us. We thought he was a New York real estate guy who just was, he was very sort of provincial and regional to New York. And it was only after Marla Maples, which, you know, seems like a very well orchestrated stunt if you look at it on, you know, I'm not suggesting that it was, but it's almost too bizarre to show up with your mistress and your wife on ski slopes in Colorado
together
in a photo and have a photo op. You know, it's just, it was all ridiculous. And I think that was at this point, there was a little bit of an epiphany among Enquirer leadership saying, oh, this guy actually could sell papers. And I think with Trump, there was a recognition like, you know, here's this paper that, you know, reaches tens of millions of Americans a week. And I think he saw, as is stated in the film, that the Enquirer could help him reach a population that would never have given him second thought.
Coming up, more with Mark Lantzman, director of the new documentary about the National Enquirer, and we'll hear from Anna Warnaker about reviving her 90s band, That Dog. Now let's get back to my conversation with Mark Lantzman. He's the director of the documentary Scandalous, The True Story of the National Enquirer. The Enquirer practiced a particular and peculiar form of journalism. Here's a clip from the film about a certain criminal trial that took place in Los Angeles.
Face to face, mano a mano, we would beat the hell out of you. I mean, okay, O.J. Simpson was the test.
Enquirer editors say they have been following abuse allegations against the former football superstar since 1989.
When the Simpson murders occurred, we knew this was a seminal moment for the National Enquirer.
So what happens during the O.J. Simpson trial, not only in terms of what the National Enquirer does, but also how their approach to gathering information and celebrity news kind of spills into mainstream media?
Unlike the mainstream outlets like the LA Times, the New York Times, Washington Post, Globe, etc., you know, who had maybe one or two reporters on this case, the Enquirer had 20. You can't compete with that kind of money. The Enquirer had been establishing a spy network in Los Angeles since the early 70s.
Just to cover celebrities.
Just to cover celebrities. And O.J. Simpson was a huge celebrity. So they had already had moles in the O.J. camp all over the place. And so when this thing hit, they were ready. They had gained the trust of the Brown and the Goldman family. They were inside that family. They knew people in the prosecutor's office. They were on the plane with Marcia Clark. You know, they were everywhere, literally everywhere. And they just couldn't be beat. When a lot of the mainstream press was looking one way, the Enquirer was looking always. They were very spherical and very holistic in their look. And that was something that couldn't be competed with.
It's also important to remember that the three major networks devoted more time to covering O.J. Simpson than they did the Oklahoma City bombing and the Bosnian War combined. So this celebrity trial, I think, is a tipping point in the tabloidization of the news media. Do you buy that argument?
I absolutely do buy it. People who study media buy it, and they think this is the point when the fabric really starts to fray. And all of a sudden, you have somebody like David Margolick in the New York Times. The headline said Enquirer required reading in the Simpson case. I mean, that was astonishing to people at the time. This is really a fast. This was really sort of one of the core questions we wanted to explore in the film is, you know, how did this all happen? How did we get here? You know, how did we get to a place where, as is said in the film, we can't have a civil debate about what is a fact. We can't have consensus on what is a fact anymore. That's a frightening thing.
The circulation of the National Enquirer has declined dramatically. What would you say its impact in the media is right now? And is it possible to make some assumptions about how it has led news organizations to behave?
I think Maggie Haberman says it best in our film when she says that people used to look at the Enquirer and know just, it was true-ish. Suddenly this thing that, you know, got its start with psychic predictions and miracle cures is endorsing presidential candidates. The hopefully the takeaway for us with people with the film is, you know, we love to point fingers. Oh, it's the big media god out there that's kind of pulling the levers and making us do all these things. But the truth is that the complicity lies with us. Brooke Gladstone wrote this book called The Influencing Machine. And in that book, she says, you know, we get the media we deserve. And it's harsh, right? It's really painful because when you wake up one morning and this is the world we're living in, you realize that that's true. So, you know, the film sort of attempted to kind of sort of connect the dots a little bit. Look at, like, how in the world did this happen?
Mark Lanzmann is the director of Scandalous. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure.
I've been reading about my baby.
Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer, is in select theaters starting November 15th. And now Anna Warnaker is a guitarist and lead singer of the alt-rock band That Dog. She, along with Tony Maxwell, Petra Hayden, and Rachel Hayden, formed the band back in the early 90s. They built a dedicated fan base with their quirky heartbreak songs, many of which featured intricate vocal and string arrangements. That Dog dissolved after their 1997 album, Retreat from the Sun, but reunited in 2011 for some shows. Warnaker told me how those gigs inspired their first new album in 22 years, called Old LP.
The idea to do a new album was so driven by our fans. I don't ever expect to have like a group of fans. Like, it was a little bit overwhelming to have so much continued love from people. And we played some reunion shows and I saw how it was affecting them. That feeling that I got from them watching us kind of traveled with me throughout the album and still does. I mean, that's a major driving force for me because I don't like to leave the house that much.
I was listening to what I'll call before and after about lyrics, and I was trying to find songs that kind of matched up a little bit in terms of a young perspective on relationships and a older perspective on relationships.
Dark.
I'm going to play a song from your new album. This is called Very Subtle, Never Want to See Your Face Again.
How many times, how many years have I sacrificed, paid a tall price to only find myself ill-advised? I put our lives
You just cut it out at the really, like, warm and fuzzy
Stained
part.
With blood and pride, that line. Okay, I'm sorry. So that's part A. Part B, this is from your 1995 album, Totally Crushed Out. This song is called He's Kissing Christian. Is that hard for you? I'm sorry.
No, this is so funny. I love this. No, I actually love this.
What do you love about it?
I love that you're finding the humor in all of it because it's written with some bit of humor, even, but it's also guttural. So I appreciate it. I appreciate kind of butting them up like that and seeing how I haven't really changed much.
I would say a little bit of the perspective has changed. And I think that's what goes with age and life,
yes,
and experience,
for sure.
That you see the world in maybe a different way, as everybody does. And some of it is, I think when you're younger, it might be more aspirational.
Yeah.
And when you're older, it's more realistic.
Yes. You know, when I first started writing songs, they were like my end of the night, try to make me feel better thing. Like I'd get home and be bummed and then I'd write the song and then I'd feel better. So they just kind of became these, like, not too bratty, but sometimes bratty or venty, like, diary entries. And writing this new album, you know, it's 20 years later, I didn't want to try to backpedal and pretend that I was still, like, crushing out on people and pissed that you didn't show up. It's like, no, I mean, life is very real and I'm talking about it, honestly.
I want to ask you about arrangements, because from your very early work, it was clear that you cared as a band deeply about arrangements and about strings.
Yes.
I want to play part of a song from the new album. This one is called Alone Again.
I'll know better than to stay and play the game unless I want to remain alone again.
I mean, it's really beautiful,
Thank
the
you.
Strings in that song
Thank
and
you.
Strings throughout your career. How do they become important to you? Because there are not a lot of people who are playing the kind of music that you were playing in the 90s who would say, violin and cello have a place in my music.
In my weird punk rock, arty punk rock band. Okay, so this is twofold. Because in the first three That Dog records, the strings were all Petra Hayden, Rachel's sister. And then we would have Tanya, their other sister, play cello. But that was primarily Petra's domain. And the way that that unfolded was I was playing Rachel my songs in her bedroom because we were like teenagers. And she was like, great, let's have a band. Let's do this. Oh my, she was so freaked out and excited. And Petra walked by and was like, what are you guys doing? And then we're going to start a band. Well, okay, I want to be in the band. Great. What do you play? Violin. Okay. I mean, and then it turns out that this is what makes bands special, you know, that there's just something that brings you together. Like, I didn't know that she'd be so skilled. I didn't know that she would be so off kilter and brilliant about it. I had no idea. But that leads us to the other side of it, which is that I come from, you know, a musical background, you know, being around pretty incredible musicians. And my grandfather was a violinist. And, you know, my dad grew up on the soundstage and produced a lot of albums, particularly with Randy Newman, where it was like very symphonic. And so I had that in me. I never thought that'd be something I could actually get out. But, you know, I just went for it on this album. And I'm so happy I did.
Growing up around the business, your dad and Mo Austin ran
Yes.
Warner Brothers Records.
Mm-hmm.
They are a business. They are selling records. They have, you know, corporate overseers. They're
Yep.
trying to sell stuff. How do you make sure that the conversations that you're having, not only with your bandmates, but with your dad, people around you, are about the music and not about the record sales?
Okay, so I really lucked out on that because my dad is legendary for being all about the art. And he somehow managed to make this incredible career staying like that. And so, you know, I get to go talk. Still, I talk to my dad about, you know, the music, the art. I'm more concerned with business and stuff like that than he is. And when I try to get some business advice, he's kind of like, maybe you want to call Mo. I don't know. That's not my thing.
Your new record
Yes.
is called Old LP. I know it's there's got to be a reason.
Old LP is about, I wrote the song after going to Rachel's father, Charlie Hayden, his memorial. And at the end of it, they played a song called Shenandoah that he sings, and it's stunning.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you.
And it kind of blew my mind, and it made me think of how interesting it is that when you listen to music and a person isn't here anymore, they're alive there, kind of, not entirely, but in a weird way. It's different than when they're acting, you know? And so I went home and I wrote the song, and it became the like anchor of our album. And also, we are older, and I have no problem with that. You're lucky to. Like, let's just roll with this. It's okay. We should have put LB because people gain weight too, and that's great.
Let's listen to it as we go out. Anna Warnocker's band is called That Dog. Their latest album is Old LP. Anna, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That Dog performs Saturday, November 16th at the Regent Theater in downtown LA. Up next on The Frame, an episode of Song Exploder with musician Rafael Sadiq.
To your favorite song, I don't want to sing.
We're always glad to have an episode of Song Exploder on our show. That's the podcast by Hrishikesh Hirway, in which he deconstructs songs with musicians. Today, it's the Grammy-winning songwriter, producer, and artist Rafael Sadiq. He was the lead singer of the influential 1990s R&B group Tony, Tony, Tony. As a producer, Sadiq has worked with D'Angelo, Mary J. Blige, Solange Knowles, and John Legend. This year, he released his fifth solo album. It's called Jimmy Lee, which is named for his late older brother. Here, Sadiq breaks down the song King's Fall, which was a family affair.
My name is Rafael Sadiq. I actually wrote this song with my nephew, Dylan Wiggins.
What's up? I'm Dylan Wiggins, a.k.a. Sir Dylan, from Oakland, California.
We work on a lot of music together, and he actually brought me the track King's Fall.
The first idea that came to me before I made that song was just this idea of these chords I had on the guitar. I was going for, an Otis Redding vibe. Something that just sounded like my grandfather's music or just something from back in the time. And then I ended up recording like a solo guitar to it. And then reversed that lead guitar I did. That's just to create the feeling of, like, falling. After the chords came the drums. And I think they were sampled from vinyl. So I chopped the sample up and then just try to make it feel as real as possible and as human as possible.
When Dylan brought me the track, it was right up my alley. I was very excited because my record is a little darker than most records, and my record is titled Jimmy Lee. So Jimmy Lee is my brother who had drug addiction, so my record is about addiction, and so it fit because it shows like very strong people in the beginning, but you know, drug addiction is something you can fall from, you know, no matter how big or strong you are or beautiful you are. So I was like, yeah, I gotta work with this. We gotta do something with this.
Drops it off to let me know how much the pills cost.
The song is really about the dealer, the person around you that makes it available, you know, just like wants to keep you high and wants to keep you down. And it's about the supplier. The person that provides and supplies can sort of hide in the dark a lot and not be mentioned when everybody's getting high. They come in the middle of the night. They're always smiling. They're always sneaky. So I just wanted to give the attention to that. My play on words was just to say, I want you to be, but that's what you are anyway. But we're just exposing it.
I want you to be my supplier, my provider, and all those things. I want you to be my provider and supplier, and all those things, and all those things. I want you to be my...
The breaths in the song, the panting is, you know, waking the body asleep in a cold sweat and just being scared. You don't know what happened, you know, just what's going on in my life. So I wanted to put those breaths behind the dope fiend reference.
Even when I'm clean, I'm still a dope fiend. Everyone is always trying to sell me something.
Even when I'm clean, I'm still a dope fiend. I'm also talking about people who are not on an actual chemical drug. Maybe it's food, maybe it's sugar, maybe it's sex, maybe it's anger, you know, just something that you can't get away. So we all have addictions.
After I sent it to him, I was just kind of like, who knows what's going to happen. And then one time I come to the studio and he's like, did I play this song? And I was like, nah. And then he played it for me and I was like, wow. I wasn't hearing that on there. I was hearing something a lot softer. But when he came with that energy, I was like, dang, this took that super sad song to like a level of emotion that it needed to go to really be something.
You know, for me talking about addiction. I've been around it growing up with my brother, Jimmy Lee. He was a bit older than me, so from the time I knew him, he was already addicted to drugs. He was pretty much curiosity kills the cat. He tried a chemical, and he never was able to relieve himself from it. It's been laced in my music for some time, but this is the first time I went 100% directly to it. And, you know, that was my take on it.
If you want to hear a longer version of that episode, go to songexploder.com. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.